How many designers does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know.
Well, does it have to be a light bulb?
Ah, out of the box thinking. I like it.
Second joke.
Okay.
How many engineers does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know.
None. According to our calculations, that problem does not exist.
Hello and welcome back to SciComm Stories after our short break. I hope you didn't miss us too much, but the wait will be worth it. We've got a new series ahead with a fantastic lineup of guests across all areas of science communication. And today, for our first episode of the series, we're going to focus on co-design and how working with your audiences to develop activities together can lead to innovative projects that have much broader reach. Now, today's case study is the award-winning science festival Smashfest UK. It's a hyperlocal festival hosted in underserved regions of the UK, where it truly embeds itself into those communities and is able to attract those kinds of audiences that traditional festivals don't often reach. And telling us all about the festival is Wynne Griffiths, who is a senior lecturer in product design and engineering at Middlesex University and a co-director of Smashfest UK. So welcome, Wynne. Thank you so much for your time today. And let's dive straight in. Tell us a bit about Smashfest UK. How did the festival come about?
It's not a really straightforward genesis or answer, really. There's a lot going on from a lot of different dimensions. But the primary impetus came from the two directors who started it were me and Dr. Lindsay Keith, who was at the time the director of the refinery, but also she was working as a producer director for BBC programmes, Channel 4 programmes. So during that period, she was doing Engineering Giants. She's, you know, worked on Scrappy Challenge, Brainiac. So stuff that's meant, you know, that was all about popularising and opening up the idea of engineering science to wider audiences. She'd come from a research science background. I had come from a design and engineering background, depending on who you speak to. Design and engineering is a very strange grey overlapping. I've had many, many job titles that have design or engineering or artist or sometimes even scientist in it. But I think scientist is too much of a stretch. Way too much of a stretch, to be honest. And my work up until this point had been in participatory design a lot. I've done a lot of industrial design, but participatory design with communities. Then I work on collaborative large-scale installations, so public installations. So I was part of the group who worked with flipping the Royal Observatory during the thing called Longitude Punked. So when they had the big time exhibition down at the Maritime Museum, they took all Harrison's pieces. So we worked with the Royal Observatory to turn the whole Royal Observatory into a kind of fictional version of itself. Wow. I built a big mechanical installation of a crashed fictional time machine in the courtyard and did various other things and films and things through there. Sorry, that's quite a long-winded answer. But the backgrounds were quite important. And I suppose the thing that then brought everything together were the original Aspires report and the Warwick Commission report, which, you know, looked at arts as opposed to, well, science, STEM more broadly.
And just to elaborate for people who might not be aware, so Aspires is, well, now a series of research projects looking into career aspirations of students within STEM, and particularly explores why some students might not aspire towards those careers. And then, as you mentioned, the Warwick Commission report did the same for the arts. So you'd seen those reports, and then what happened?
So that was our starting point, thinking about, okay, based on our experiences, based on what we do, what we've done, who we work with, could we do something about this?
Yeah.
I guess, the starting point was looking at the equality, diversity and inclusion, social justice mission. How we started, what we did then is, because of our backgrounds, design engineering, combination of research science and TV film production, we looked at it through those lenses because we were aware, we're aware of lots of festivals, installations, programs and so on happening, but of very little change. So they seem to be pouring lots of energy, money, effort, ingenuity into the landscape, but there was little tangible change. So we started approaching it as I would a design project. The key thing about Smashfest, I suppose, one of the key things, the unique factors, it is and has always been design-led. So it's the design perspective. And the design perspective in the sense of thinking about what this issue is, this big, complex, we often call them wicked problems, I'm trying to find a way in to work with people within that landscape to develop ideas, prototype those ideas, and move towards innovation within the landscape. So in terms of trying to achieve that strategic mission, we started with, you know, who are we working with? Who is this for? It's often overlooked in terms of festivals, as far as I see, and in terms of special exhibitions in the Science Museum, in terms of outreach programs. They ostensibly have an audience in mind, but they don't understand or don't seem to understand the broader set of stakeholders, who this is really for, where the central focus is, and then why are you doing this? You know, what are you trying to achieve? So we then started co-design workshops, if you like, with this design approach, with stakeholders that we'd identified. So that included community organisations or charitable organisations. We chose Deptford in Southeast London as our kind of starting target area. It had the demographics, it had very high levels of poverty, very high diversity. It was very suitable, you know, if you think of it coldly as an experimental area, but also, you know, it's an area that we knew. And one of the key things is having ways into communities. If you're going to work with communities, knowing something about them and having ways in. So, you know, we worked with various community groups in the area, speaking with them. We worked with organisations such as the Lewisham Young Advisors Group. We worked with teenagers. We worked with students from some of our collaborating institutions. We worked with specialists, engineers, scientists, you know, from sectors, and we started to build this picture, and the idea resolved initially into a festival. It was never just a festival. You know, that the festival has always had a program of co-design workshops around it, which are critical. You know, everything we do, every time we do it, it evolves. So there's a mindset to what we do. We've never done a finished festival. Each one is a prototype. They will never stay the same, and they should never stay the same, because a maxim in design is, you know, you can ask the same question 6 months apart and you'll get a different answer, because the world will have changed. Technology will have changed. Needs will have changed. Demographics will have changed. So we obviously have a thing that it resolves to each time, whether that be the co-design program, whether it be an outreach program, whether it's a festival that sits within that. But that will change based on the delivery of it. Once we deliver it, it's not done. That's the prototype being tested. So we can then start feeding the results of that into the next cycle. So it's a continuous cycle of evolution and development. And, you know, we're also looking at the slightly more formal perspective on that, which is community-based participatory action research. So, you know, that's the formal research side of it, but that's interwoven with design research. And part of what we're doing is creating a hybrid method for this. And that's one of the things we're about to publish. So probably going into any detail on that would...
no worries. We don't want anyone scooping you, so we won't go into that, but hopefully it might be up by the time the episode's out, so we can link to that.
Yeah, well, I'll let you know once we've got that.
That's brilliant. But without going into too much detail now, could you tell us some of the things you learned through that core design process?
So some of the principles that came from the first cycle of co-design were that it needed to be entertainment led. So the branding of it was important.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's not branded as a science festival or STEM festival or arts festival, because, you know, a lot of the insights we gathered in working with various groups are about invisible and visible barriers. Visible barriers such as it has to be free. So everything we do is free at the point of delivery. There are no charges for anything. The invisible barriers are to do with cultural capital, social capital, expectations, you know, the exclusion that happens across society. And therefore, you know, a simple one, if it's a science festival, segments have had it beaten into them, if you like, that science isn't for them. So the entertainment was the lead there. That opened up more audience participation. We came up with some slogans: science by stealth, engineering undercover, arts in the open.
Yeah.
That was one of our slogans. You know, so come along, it's a fun thing, and then all the seriousness is underneath. Another thing that came from the initial, you know, one of the principles, the founding principles, if you like, is it's narrative led. So it's all within a big story.
Right, because each edition has its own story, doesn't it? That somehow involves the destruction of Earth.
Luckily, that doesn't happen. You know, we manage to save the Earth each time, or we escape. But the storyline, that disaster movie storyline, again, satisfies a few different things. So the disaster movie can be considered cheesy, but it's eternally popular and, you know, recycles again and again and again. It also gives a meaningful context. And that's one of the key things, again, jumping forward a little bit, too many festivals or installations we see, they don't interweave everything into a context that makes sense and is meaningful to the audience, the people who are experiencing it.
Yeah, and what does that story, that context provide, do you think?
By having a meaningful context, a top-level story, the world's going to get destroyed by, and our first story was an asteroid, second story was a gigantic solar storm, third story was a super volcano, and that was, it was terrible that people have managed to miss, there was a giant magma chamber underneath Lewisham, you know. super volcano, then a giant flood, and our current cycle is called space blue. So we've got a virulent disease, an astrobiological virulent disease landing, and through that storyline you can interweave everything, you can make everything meaningful, because it's not any, you're not siloing things saying here's some science and it's interesting in and of itself. Your existence, your community, your life, you know, telling stories about your community interweaves with understanding the engineering behind your heating systems and your water supply systems and your sanitation systems, or so it all, then it's all meaningful. That's critical. Everything is driven by, as I said, design, by co-design, co-production, co-delivery with the community. So our little phrase there is in the community with the community. Critical there again, you know, it's about going to communities, not about asking communities to come to you. One of the biggest things, you know, identifying factors for getting people to participate, participants who would not normally participate, is don't say it's free, come to Kensington.
Yeah, because then it's not actually free.
Well, it is. It's not actually free, but it doesn't matter. You know, even if you say the tube is going to be free that day, it's in Kensington. It's somewhere else.
Yeah, the burden is on them to then go out of their way to come to you.
Yes, indeed. So going to people is critical. And then the other thing then was making sure it's all underpinned by these cross-sectoral, interdisciplinary partnerships and collaborations. So we've worked with 15 universities, lots of different learned societies, lots of different research groups, lots of different community organisations, lots of different charitable organisations, lots of different individuals, lots of schools, and bringing them all together and interweaving the know-how that comes from that and working out mechanisms to have all of those contributing. And, you know, so contributing to the thing itself, but also as a mechanism to change perceptions on how you do things for them as well. So, you know, trying to help big institutions, big charities, big funding bodies think about their policies and approaches and how they can modify themselves as well. You know, and that's probably the biggest mission of all, because a lot of the way the things are done are because of the structures that sit above. But it's the governmental, institutional and organisational structures that force them towards doing things in particular ways. Yeah. Reinforcing, you know, if they've got a big museum, reinforcing, desperately trying to get footprint in the museum as opposed to taking the museum to people, or universities using public engagement programs or outreach programs as recruitment mechanisms rather than transforming communities around them, transforming society on the whole. You know, so there's another mindset thing that we know we're trying to use this as a case study and a method and approach that can inform change in the structural level as well.
Very true. And I think that's what a lot of public engagement professionals struggle with, because, you know, it's a bit of a battle between what you want to do, what your institution wants you to do, and what the limitations of your funding are. Because the way things are funded, a lot of the time, just through writing the grant application, you're making decisions about what your project's going to be, A, to appease the requirements of the grant, whatever they are, but B, to also showcase what you're planning to do. But then Smashfest UK is obviously something that's been so open and flexible, so I was wondering how you navigated that part of the project. Did you have to run some of it first with a view to getting funding when you had a clearer picture, or were you able to get funded before you even had a clue how it was going to manifest?
Everything sort of worked in parallel. It's kind of like a, as I said, design approaches. You know, you need to establish the principle, the idea, but also the feasibility roughly at the same time. What we were doing is talking and working with and doing workshops and, you know, with some people, giving presentations to other people, having meetings with other people all at the same time. Because, you know, the danger otherwise, especially with a community-based project, you go in, you do lots of amazing work, you make lots of promises, then you don't get any funding and you go away and you leave the community exactly where it was before, except feeling a little more bitter because there were all these amazing things we're going to do, but actually it's not feasible and they'll never be done. So off we go back to our metaphorical towers and just leave a load of broken promises behind.
Exactly, because that's the kind of thing I was worried about, because I would have thought, you know, I have to secure the funding before I even start anything because I don't want to abandon people in the middle of a project. So did you have that initial support from your institution or a charity or anything like that?
Yeah, we went to lots of Lindsay wasn't with the University of Greenwich at that point, but I was with Middlesex University, and were brilliant. They were absolutely brilliant. They gave support from the start. You know, it took a little persuasion because it's very, very different to their normal metrics. You know, that's all along. The challenges in terms of fundraising have been difficult, because what we're in essence saying to institutions, funders, businesses, you know what you normally do? You need to give us money so you don't do that anymore. It's a difficult conversation to have. But obviously, you don't have it in those terms. But Middlesex were brilliant. They gave loads and loads of in-kind support, but they also gave seed funding to start. And then the Wellcome Trust were brilliant. They were our initial major funder and carried on funding throughout. We've then built up relationships with other fantastic funders. The STFC have been particularly brilliant. Royal Academy of Engineering have been brilliant. And the Arts Council have been brilliant. So it's always been really nice to have that mix, engineering, arts, science, biological sciences, physical sciences as funders. That helps. Of course, it's difficult when you've got siloed funders, which again is another thing that needs challenging. You know, all these funders doing their particular area, trying to communicate with each one that this interdisciplinary, interwoven type thing is relevant to their particular sector. Bit of a wrestle, but we manage most of the time. Businesses have been harder to crack because they are very, very focused. You know, they're in a world of metrics and KPIs, so how will this help our direct recruitment within the next 2 years? Well, it won't. It won't, because this is a long-term project. We love what you're doing, but we're not going to give you any money. So we've had some industry support, not as much as we'd have liked. My favourite bit of industry support we had was a forensic software analysis company in Australia. So what we were doing online and said, we'd like to support this. And we had the opposite conversation with them. You know, normally trying to persuade the industrial people, it'll be good in the long term. What we're doing is, they love words like pipeline, developing a pipeline, a broader pipeline, diverse workforce, better ideas, blah, 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 blah. Because you've got to give them the tangible things. And they're like, agree. But we have priorities on our spending this year. So this Australian company got in touch and they were like, yeah, we'd love to support that. And we're like, we don't operate in Australia. and whereas, we've ambitions to spread this. It's going to be a long time, even if there's any direct benefits. And like, no, we it's for us. We've got a social justice mission on top of our financial thing. And we think this is a great thing. It's a great initiative. And if we support it, it acts as a case study, and to try and change things over here as well. So we'll stop trying to persuade you not to give us some money.
Yeah, take it before they change their mind.
it wasn't a huge amount, but it was those sorts of small things are really uplifting, just to see.
Yeah, because you're struggling to find funders and then someone just out of the blue sees the value of what you're doing and just hands you money.
this is a good thing. We like to do good things. And it's like, oh, look, you're like Google used to be.
Yeah, they all start like that, don't they? But moving away slightly from financial challenges, I'm sure there's an amazing amount of logistics and planning that goes into something like this. So what are those major obstacles and how did you overcome them?
Kind of usual ones there that we've just been talking about. So funding is a wrestle. Sectoral resistance has been a wrestle throughout. If you're trying to do innovation, there's a lot of resistance. Institutional misunderstanding and dismissal of the work. That's been an interesting tightrope to walk. Because of the, from an academic side, because we're taking this CBPAR approach and being embedded as part of the mission and prototyping, sometimes academic institutions see that there's less valid research in terms of methodology, especially if you're in science and tech. But more the case that the front end, especially in the early years, the front end communication that we did about it, entertainment, not STEM and the arts, had to be very, very friendly and open because, we were trying to attract families from underrepresented and underserved communities, trying to break down invisible barriers. So it couldn't sound academic. It couldn't sound the sort of thing that would be valued in institutions. It had to sound like a fun thing. And all of the more serious stuff was hidden. So there's been a lot of misunderstanding that, that fun thing for kids. There's a perceptual barrier there that's been, funding is a continuing wrestle, especially as, we've got into a pretty good place, but there's lots of changes going on at the moment with UKRI. Wellcome have restructured. their funding policies and everything. So you know, those challenges will continue. And then, you know, the participation element is always interesting. You know, how you connect with the communities, who you connect with. There are good ways to do that and bad ways to do that. But there are some challenges, however you do the good ways or bad ways. One of the ones that was the younger teenagers, student 18 plus, fine, we got all sorts of engagement there. The 13 to 16, 17 age group is the most challenging. When we started, they were our primary target area for the festival. But of course, the minute we did the first festival, the prototype, and we had better attendance than we expected, but the demographics were 7 to 12 and their parents and or carers, which is great, you know, because the intergenerational thing is really, really critical. You know, that's, again, part of the misunderstanding. It makes it look like fun for kids, but probably it's the parents we are more interested in transforming, you know, the science capital analogy of the candle and the air around the candle. Well, you know, the air around the candle is critical, and that's why we've phrased it in a way that it's for families. But if you're a teenager, the last thing you want to do is spend your time in a family festival full of 7 to 12 year olds. And we missed that totally in the first one because we'd worked, you know, a lot of our co-design had been done with that age group. But in, you know, the loads of ideas, loads of insights, loads of really great things. And my favorite anecdote comes from that, which is whenever I'm talking to people who are talking about doing co-design, it's a kind of remember this story because it's really critical for how you think about doing co-design. But yeah, so we had all this input, then of course they're not going to come. So because we think of it as a prototype, that challenge became a really positive thing for the next year. So we kind of went back into the co-design cycle and then designed the fact that instead of expecting that teenage group to come, we need to spend more time with them creating stuff and actually delivering the festival. So we started a Young Explainers and Young Science Innovators program. So we had 60 one year, but that was too many people to manage for the scale of what we're going to do. But we have about 20 young people of that age group who come and work on the festival. They help deliver the festival, and we partner them up with professional facilitators, give them training. But we also then create as many new productions, so whether that's an immersive or semi-immersive installation or a theatre show that includes young people. Our current fully immersive festival, so this is the first fully immersive experience that we've done as a coherent single thing, has two different community drama groups, one from Riverside, which is in the Evelyn Ward, which is the most deprived ward of Lewisham, and one out in Woolwich. So there's 20 young people of that age group working on developing the storyline and characters and films for it, and so on. You know, we work with other groups of that age, developing interactives with them. So instead of coming to the festival, they produce the festival and design the festival and take part in the festival and deliver the festival. So, you know, that was useful because of the mindset of prototyping. We were able to kind of revision that and reimagine that and redesign it to be different, a more effective approach very rapidly. The anecdote is during our first Lewisham Young Advisors co-design workshop, so it's about 40-odd. So, you know, a significant number of 15 to 17-year-olds there. And we've got this initial framework, the suggestion of, you know, perhaps some directions just to feed the conversations, but we're open to everything, apart from zombies. We're not having zombies. Because zombies are, you know, a hoary old cliche. They're not scientifically valid, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're overused at the moment. And of course, the one thing that everybody's ever reading that was needed was zombies.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were left in this situation having a very honest conversation with the core team of, are we really doing co-design here? You know, because lots of people spout out about co-creation and co-design. And they're not really. It's just a tick box. You know, co-design at the moment's become a bit of a buzzword. You know, we've been doing it for 6 years. You know, currently it's a bit of a buzzword, overused. But it has to be done properly. So for us then, it was a question, if we're faking it, we can not use zombies. You know, if we just tick boxing, but if we are doing this properly and it's interwoven into our thinking and our method, zombies, it has to be. We can't avoid zombies. So, you know, we spun it around to the asteroid had some initial impacts, smaller ones, and some unknown virus was causing zombie-like symptoms in people around. So zombie-like symptoms, you know, was the satisfactory outcome. You know, we worked back with them, and everybody loved that. So, of course, we had zombie workshop, makeup workshops. We got a special effects artist in the zombie. We then made a co-created zombie film. in a kind of documentary format. We've got the mayor of Lewisham taking part, making an announcement, young people from the schools and students, and you know, in the zombie makeup, zombies ran through one of our final stage shows. Actually, we did transmedia final stage show, so there was film involved, there was live action, and then there was interventions from zombies in the crowd and so on. And you know, it was explicable. You know, we, in terms of the storyline, we do good sci-fi, if you see what I mean. You know, sci-fi that is hyper-realistic, but not just random time machines and, you know, flying shit.
Yeah, it reminds me of a project, actually, that I ran called Escape Malta, and it was meant to be a series of escape rooms built into this live street game, and we wanted to use zombies, but in a more scientific way. And I remembered learning in my undergrad, you know, Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds?
Yeah.
So apparently he was inspired to create that based on a real event. He saw birds going crazy on the coastline. And it's because occasionally you have these algal blooms of a species of algae that produces this neurotoxin. And the shrimp that eat the algae, their brains are simplistic enough that the toxin is kind of benign. But the birds then eat those shrimp and it does affect them. It makes them go crazy, you know, flying into walls and so on. So we built this idea into the game that there was neurotoxins in the seawater. And it just so happened that Malta gets a lot of its tap water by filtering seawater. And there was some concern that people were overusing water. You know, the filtration systems are being overwhelmed. So we had a storyline that the systems were damaged and the toxins were getting into tap water and turning people into crazed zombie-like maniacs.
Yeah.
So we were able to bring in this kind of topical civic issue into it while also being able to explain things scientifically. And I think that all happened because we started with something fun that people enjoy and then worked backwards. Because I think if you go to really creative or artistic places and then you try to explain that scientifically, it naturally brings out these really interesting scientific narratives that are both educational but also exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's no rising from the dead going on here. You know, yeah. Brain affected, you know, behavioral affected. And it opens up lots of interesting conversations then as well. You know, if you've got drop-in areas, talk some more about this, as you know, to help support the storyline stuff. So yeah, as you say, as long as you don't go into bad science fiction, stuff that could never happen or is just nonsense, you know, stretching reality a little bit is a great way to open those conversations. And if there's something that is as engaging for a wide range of audience visitors as that, you can't dismiss it. It's part of that thing, you know, there's a certain amount of snobbery as well, zombie movies, disaster movies, like, yeah, in a highfalutin academic environment, I get your point, but who is this for? Why are you doing it? You know, where is this going to be? Is this appropriate there? Have you worked with the groups that you want to work with? Yes, yes, yes. Okay, this is why it's being done, you know, and that comes back to that mindset and the methods and approaches that you begin with.
Yeah, you're starting with what people are excited by and then you bring in the science into that.
Yeah, not some deficit model or some sledgehammer where you people need to know this and this is important and good.
Yeah, definitely. And I think another thing that kind of annoys me just as much as the deficit model thinking is when people assume everything has to be educational, you know, the audience has to walk away with some new knowledge. Because I think sometimes having just a positive experience, you know, that then leads to a positive association with science is just as powerful. And sometimes it's a better way to build relationships with new audiences. But of course, you know, a festival is usually only one event, it's once a year. And is that enough to do that? So I was wondering, in your opinion, what do you think of festivals? What do you think they can and can't achieve?
My opinions on festivals vary. I think on their own, as a, you know, as a standalone thing, they can be a positive and inspiring experience.
Yeah.
I think really for further meaningful change, they've got to be part of something ongoing. Because they're episodic, there's only so much they can do. If they're part of ongoing programs, you know, working with groups, whether it's then, you know, for us, it's co-design on the way in, it's outreach as well. And, you know, that's the ongoing thing that develops beyond the episodic nature. What's there and the connections and the networks that come from it, they can have broader positive effect. But as standalones, they they tend to be something that's a positive experience for those who are already, you know, if you want to use the capital thing, already fairly well provided with science capital or STEM capital or cultural capital. But I think that effectiveness as well is also dependent upon how they've been envisaged initially. You know, it comes back to my thing about the understanding the stakeholders, horrible word, I know, apologies for that, but the broader group of people that this has meaning to, who might contribute, participate within it. So who is this for and why are you doing it?
Yeah, I agree. And I think, as you mentioned, the way a festival is designed will impact the kind of audience it draws. But I also think it's very difficult when things move from planning or visioning into implementation. People tend to drift away from what their original aims are. It's quite easy to do that. So did you experience that? And how did you stay true to your original intent?
One of the really interesting things we had happen, and we had to make a very difficult choice about, came after second main cycle. So we've had these big story cycles, so the, you know, the four annual week-long festivals in Deptford, but around that we've done one day, sometimes 2 day pop-ups around the country in similar communities, you know, from Bradford, Neath, Gloucester, other bits of London. So we've done I think I've topped it up the other day, depending on how we count things, we've done about 20 of those key events alongside outreach programs, co-design programs that support them. And part of that again was our prototyping mindset to test, okay, this works with a Deptford audience. Now, can it work with a Bradford or a Neath audience? Work in that community, the general methods. And the answer was yes, roughly. It works perfectly, obviously. And hence, hence the prototyping mindset. But in terms of the audience, we started. So we were, you know, local advertising, working with residents associations, schools, postering in local businesses and stuff like that, attracted a local audience. The second year, we wanted to try marketing in a wider sense. So, you know, we made an effort. We got featured in Metro and Time Out and The Guardian and The Times. And this was all great. This is a nice little ego stroke for us all. Oh, look, aren't we great? Look, we're in The Times. Oh, aren't we great? We're in The Guardian. Well, actually, no. It's not terrible. We're in The Times. Oh, isn't it great? We're in The Guardian. but following that, during Supervolcano, we started to notice a demographic drift in our attendance. So as we became known and therefore valuable in some people's perceptions, because we were in these bigger things, we started to get people turning up to this event from all over London and outside London, in addition to our local audiences. So we didn't lose local audiences, but we gained audience overall. But the proportion of local audiences and representative audiences dropped a little, only a little, but enough to be noticeable. And for us to take a deep breath and say, okay, so how do we rebalance to the audiences who don't normally attend this type of thing? How do we make sure that we don't start to lose the balance in our representative communities, in our localities? For that year, then, we took the decision to spend no money or time marketing towards larger publications, and we refocused all of the resources that we put into those to additional residents' association or community group workshops and local advertising. So that worked. And we also recognised that one of our venues, one of our community venues, was more representative of the local community than the other. So we also rebalanced and put even more activities there. We grew the audience again overall, but that audience grew and the representative proportions of the audience grew back towards fully representative of the community.
Yeah, and thank you for that, because I think that's a really good example of why it's important to be reflexive.
Yeah, and it was one of those difficult ones. It's only because of that design mindset about who and why and what, you know, and where we're trying to do this. The step back, because, you know, the standard mindset for any marketing, more, bigger, you know, wider. But, you know, you've got to then go, okay, what are we trying to do and why?
Yeah, and as long as you keep reflecting on your aims, hopefully it stops you drifting away from them.
You don't get seduced by the general approach.
Exactly. So is this the kind of main piece of advice you'd give others then for trying to run a science festival?
I think before they do anything else, they've got to ask those questions. Why are you doing this? You know, who's it for? And then start asking the questions about, you know, where's it going to be? What's it going to aim to achieve? But what's it going to do? Then you can get on, you know, down to how and everything. But it's why? Why? Start with why. I find so many people I've spoken to or are thinking of doing things, their answer to that is because.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this? Well, because. Well, okay. That's not a good enough answer.
Definitely, because you're trying to plan a journey then to an unknown destination, really. And would you have any other advice or any other things people should consider that you could share with us?
Yeah, the team. If you know, once you've got a compelling vision for why and who's this for and everything, who have you got working on it? How are you going to do, you know, how are you going to put together a team that can do this? What skills, what expertise have you got? And how do you align that with what you want to do and why you're doing it?
Yeah, and I suppose that was critical for you guys, because your design thinking background really fed into the project.
Yeah. We were lucky in the sense that we were what we were.
Yeah.
Together to do something with that. But, you know, from my particular perspective, with the co-design perspective, you know, it becoming a bit of a buzzword the last 6 months or so. But I see very few designers involved. So who's going to do this? Or then, you know, you could say from Lindsay's perspective, you know, this, oh yeah, we're going to have lots of films and we're going to make lots of films. And so what filmmakers have you got involved? And, you know, you can do that for any of the specific areas of expertise. Of course, you know, it's great that we all do stuff that we're not specifically trained within, because in these sorts of environments, you've got to, you can't, you know, I'm sitting here, principal investigator on some grant and trying to become an accountant on it, you know. So great if I had an accountant in the team rather than me. But
yeah.
Generally speaking, it's small teams and there's only so much expertise you can have within the teams and external funding. But thinking about what capabilities are and what you really need is really important.
Yeah, so as far as possible, get someone who has that specialist skill.
Yeah, and you know, there's no one skill, is there? You know, there's this range of things. Yeah, if you've got something very specific that involves a very specific skill, trying to have that expertise within your team, or access to that expertise at least, or access to training about that expertise at least. Not, you know, not a half day workshop. Every half day, we've done a 2-hour workshop in this. We're all experts now. You see a lot of that in the sector as well.
Yeah. And I suppose sometimes as well, it's, you know, the spirit of, well, this is all we've got, so we'll just have to get stuck in.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean, you know. But I'm also very, very aware, small teams, not enough funding ever. So and part of the joy of it is learning new skills. Don't get me wrong. It's like, you should stick to what you know and do. But having a sensible overview on the balance there.
Yeah, knowing the balance, I like that. And we're quickly running out of time now, so I just wanted to end on one more personal question, which is, why do you communicate science? What, you know, what are your personal reasons for doing this?
I'm not really a science communicator. In the terms of the alt-right, I am a proud social justice warrior. That's why I'm interested in this. You know, and for me, you can't separate science from social justice. You can't separate the arts. You can't separate engineering. You know, I wanted to be all part of this meaningful context. It's all about meaningful context. And there are clear inequities and imbalances in STEM progression. And some of the most exciting and interesting things about any meaningful context are STEM related. So
yeah.
I want that to be a wonderful, exciting part of the interwoven reality that everybody's experiencing, and them to have the opportunities, if they so choose, to go in the direction, to go in the science direction, to go in the engineering direction, and have all the support possible there. But equally, if from this, from, you know, the experiences that we create, somebody decides they want to go into acting or into sociology or into design even, God help them, that should equally be, you know, an opening and an opportunity that would be supported through this.
Right, well, on that note, we'll end the interview there. But before we wrap up completely, you might remember, if you can stretch your memory back 2 weeks ago, I asked maths engagement freelancer Katie Steckles the question, if she could wake up tomorrow with the solution to any major maths conundrum, which one would it be? Now, there's been a bit of a longer wait for this one than usual, so I won't waste any more time, and we'll play that answer now.
Ooh. Well, I mean, the obvious answer would be one of the $1 million prizes, right? There's a series of problems that the Clay Institute nominated in the year 2000 as the Millennium Prize problems. And for each one of them, there is $1 million prize. So if you can actually solve it, then... and it's things like the Riemann hypothesis. So this sort of question about what's the pattern in prime numbers and stuff like that. Like, really fundamental questions. Mm. Although sadly for me, the one that is in the area of maths that I did my research in, which was topology, the one question that was the sort of topology geometry one, the Poincaré conjecture, has already been solved.
Oh, no.
So I can't win that one.
Oh.
So that's a shame. And I don't know enough maths about the other maths to do any of the others. You know.
And with this theorem, what would it have meant for ordinary people? You know, how does it impact society now that it's solved?
Yeah. I think in terms of these sort of really high-level maths theorems, they make a huge difference to people within maths.
Yeah.
And probably not that much difference elsewhere. Right. You know, like no one noticed. I think the main reason that got in the news was because the person who did the proof, it was like 2004, I think, when the final proof was approved.
Yeah.
Wasn't really interested in $1 million. Like, they kind of just wanted to carry on doing maths. That wasn't what they were in it for. So the news story became weird maths person rejects prize of $1 million and doesn't want $1 million. And everyone was like, who is this? Why are they, you know, why do they not want this money? Which was a bit, you know, like, all right, it's a reasonable position to take. But the money, I think the institute that awards the prize eventually, because they were like, what do we do with this money?
Yeah.
They've eventually awarded it to a research institute in France named after the person that the Poincaré conjecture was named after.
Aww.
So it's sort of a related organization, and it's funding research. So people can now do PhDs there because of that funding, which Aww. I think is quite nice. It's gone back into maths. It's kind of...
And that's probably what this mathematician would have wanted.
Mm, yeah.
So that's all we have from Katie for now, but I can imagine you're wondering, what question do I have for Wynn? Well, I asked him, if money and resources were no object, what science communication project would he most like to take on? But that's it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. It's fantastic to be back, and as I say, we've got some great guests in the lineup who personally I've already learned so much from already, and I can't wait to share that with you. So keep looking out for us early in the week, follow us on social media, check out the website where we keep all the links to anything our guests have shared, including what today's guest Wynn has shared with us. Otherwise, have a brilliant week, and I'll see you again on Monday.